Good evening. Good evening. I hope it's working. Yeah, it is working. I'm delighted to introduce Olly Rehn, who's the member of the commission responsible for EU enlargement. Olly is unfortunately not a former student of the London School of Economics. He did his PhD, his DPhil at the University of Oxford, and while halfway through, he casually remarked to his supervisor that he was going to stand for Parliament in Helsinki for the Centre Party, but he said, you know what these Liberal parties are, we never win seats in urban areas. So his supervisor wasn't very concerned about this. Unfortunately, the Centre Party's vote went up very considerably, and it was to Olly's credit that he nevertheless completed his thesis while a Member of Parliament on comparative political economy of small states in an open global economy. Since then, he has been advisor to the Prime Minister on European matters, briefly a member of the European Parliament, put his career at jeopardy by standing up for Alpo Rusi, a friend and colleague, when Alpo was accused of having been a spy for the Soviet Union by the Finnish security services. I remember that well because my Finnish tutees at the LSE would give me weekly updates on what was going on. As I've warned Olly, there were many very bright Finnish students at the LSE, no doubt a few in the audience, and has now become the Commissioner for EU Enlargement, is thus travelling a great deal around the edges of the European Union, about which he's going to talk to us tonight. Olly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, William. Dear members of faculty, dear students, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure to be here this evening at the London School of Economics and Political Science. This institution has educated many generations of Europe's leaders and policy entrepreneurs, and I can see the next generation sitting here in front of me. As William said, I did my own doctorate at Oxford, but indeed under the supervision of one of the LSE's leading lights over many years, i.e. William, who is now a professor emeritus and still a working peer, Lord Wallis of Saltaire. I think he was only knighted because he channeled me through my doctoral thesis and got some results in that regard. Dear friends, in the current debate on the future of Europe, it is worth recalling one of William's long-standing warnings against overly simplistic explanations of how European integration develops and moves forward. He once wrote, which I have kept in mind, quote, it is far easier to agree on the interconnection between deliberate processes of political integration and informal processes of economic and social integration than to establish any clear line of causation between them, unquote. And it was indeed William who taught me that European integration is an interactive process of economic and political forces, in other words, states and markets. And these forces work on different timescales. Political development occurs over long periods of stability with sudden breaks of discontinuity, as we saw with the 40-year-long Cold War and its sudden end in 1989. Economic and technological change, on its part, is more gradual and continuous, and it tends to follow long cycles of innovation and consolidation, which Joseph Schumpeter described as the creative forces of destruction, and short-term business cycles, which stimulated the demand management theories of John Maynard Keynes. And we see these dynamics at work in Europe today. The long, deliberate process of the political development of the European Union has been disrupted by the referenda on the constitutional treaty in France and the Netherlands, prompting talk of crisis. But this sense of crisis also stems from slow economic growth and high unemployment, giving rise to social discontent and recently also street violence in France's inner cities. In reality, we need both an economic Europe and a political Europe. We need economic reforms to enhance competitiveness and employment, and we need political reforms to make the Union more effective and democratic. The founders of the London School of Economics and Political Science were farsighted in putting both disciplines together in this institution, also from the point of view of development of the European Union. The same goes for deepening and widening of the European Union, or strengthening European political integration and extending the zone of peace, liberty, democracy and prosperity in our continent. Putting widening against deepening is a false dichotomy. The EU has always pursued these two objectives in parallel. As the veteran Belgian diplomat Philippe Descoutet argues, the debate turns to be a match between widening and deepening, or between those who support an intensive Europe and emphasize unity, and those who support enlarging Europe and emphasize diversity. But this debate is not relevant since Europe as a continent cannot give up enlargement without denying its vocation, nor can it give up deepening without losing its dynamism. As we have always needed to reconcile unity and diversity, we should also reconcile widening and deepening. I very much agree, and in fact, the European Union has always made its most significant developments at the same time as it has enlarged. The first enlargement in 1973, which concerned the country where we are today, to the United Kingdom, Denmark and Ireland, was preceded by two significant initiatives in 1970. That is the Davignon Report, which kicked off European political cooperation, the precursor of the EU's common foreign and security policy, and by the Werner Report, which started the first, though short-lived, effort to create a monetary union in Europe. The two southern enlargements of the 1980s to Greece, Portugal and Spain coincided with the adoption of the Single European Act in 1986, which was essential in helping to create the single market, which is currently reality in Europe. Then the Berlin Wall came down. The EU started the 21st century as a very different community from the one of the Cold War era. And it may well be that the future history books characterize the era that began in 1989 as the second great transformation of post-war Europe, following the first transformation immediately after the Second World War, when European integration was established. During Europe's second transformation, both deepening and widening have again moved forward in parallel. Take widening. The EU has more than doubled its membership from 12 to 25 member states after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Austria, Finland and Sweden joined in 1995, and in 2004 came the Big Bang when 8 countries of Eastern and Central Europe joined the Union after successful democratic transformation together with Cyprus and Malta. Bulgaria and Romania, which are part of this fifth round of enlargement, will join the Union in either 2007 or 2008. Take deepening. The Union has also taken major steps in its political and economic integration while undertaking its biggest enlargement ever. We created the single market, monetary union, and passport-free travel in the Schengen area, and we reinforced the common foreign and security policy. A coordinated approach to internal security is vital and has progressed in order to protect European citizens from the threat of terrorism. And with the euro, the single currency, every European has a little piece of Europe in her pocket, as Romano Prodi, ex-president of the European Commission, quite aptly put it. The EU's ability to respond to its citizens' concerns must increase, but it is important to recall enlargement does not stop it from doing so on the basis of empirical evidence. Dear friends, this second transformation of Europe remains unfinished business, however. And to complete it, we need to take a dynamic view of the world, not a static one. Of course, after this transformation, another challenge is sure to arrive. The EU's great strength has been its ability to adapt to new circumstances. Although the integration project began in the very different context of post-war reconciliation, especially between France and Germany, it has adapted Europe to meet the challenges of economic globalization and the end of communism. Adaptation is indeed the key to the EU's future success too. The EU is a living political animal, not a fossil of any kind. It must continue to evolve, and it can do this through practical steps to make the Union function better, starting under the current framework of the Nice Treaty. I consider further institutional reforms necessary to make our decision-making more effective, efficient, and fair, and to reinforce our common foreign and security policy. I believe the best way out of our current constitutional dilemma is to focus on concrete measures to improve the way the EU works, not a long theoretical debate. At heart, I can confess I remain a functionalist and proud of it. As a functionalist, I regard the performance of the European economy as the key to success of the EU's performance by rebuilding confidence at the political level. Economic growth, employment and competitiveness bring security to citizens and increase the legitimacy of politicians. Political leaders have a greater margin to maneuver in dealing with the policy challenges when their citizens have a confidence that the economy can weather new storms and generate new jobs. Enlargement is not part of the problem, but part of the solution to these economic challenges. We have in fact a sound economic story to tell about enlargement for both new and old member states. But frankly, we have failed to communicate this success story sufficiently well. Both the Commission and national political leaders have been better at doing enlargement than communicating enlargement. The usual narrative on the economics of enlargement is a zero-sum game of low-cost production and delocalization. But the alternative narrative is that of mutually beneficial industrial restructuring inside an enlarged and competitive Europe based on cross-national production networks, which can be a genuine win-win situation for both old and new member states. Let's look at some empirical evidence for these two narratives. Last year, the new member states grew at double the rate of the old EU 15 on average. Growth was even stronger in the countries in the accession process, for instance, at over 9% in Turkey and over 8% in Romania. This dynamism is central. In Central, Eastern and Southeastern Europe is welcome, and it will benefit all of us. New economic opportunities, both to produce goods and to sell them in the markets of the enlargement countries, can create jobs in all of the member states. And indeed, trade between the old EU 15 countries and the Central and Eastern European members has quadrupled since the first half of the 1990s in 10 years. The number of jobs created in the old member states is clearly higher than the number of jobs lost owing to the movement of manufacturing plants to other parts of Europe. The Velvet Revolutions of 1989 in Central and Eastern Europe opened up a market of 100 million people to the companies of Western Europe, providing great business opportunities for them, for example, for French supermarket chains and car manufacturers, and for Dutch telecom firms and foodstuff producers, as well as for countless German Mittelstand companies, as well as countless service companies from the United Kingdom. The delocalization debate has also failed to include the positive impact of this kind of industrial restructuring based on a diversity of production functions, as our colleague John Zeisman points out. He's a well-known political economist, at least to Professor Wallis and some others here. John underlines the importance of this diversity of production functions, which I'm sure all the economists can easily grasp, and that is very crucial for the long-term competitiveness of the European economy. An example of job creation in Western Europe through industrial restructuring is the Renault Logan car. The project has created more than 750 jobs in engineering, purchasing, and with suppliers in the old member states of the Union through Renault's expansion of production, mainly in Romania. And it is not a question just of utilizing cheap manual work. For example, Romania trains the largest number of IT engineers in the world after India. At the headquarters of the Microsoft in Washington, Romanians are the second largest group of foreigners after Indians. However, according to the representatives of the company I met recently, during the last 2 years, Romanians have been increasingly returning to their home country to take up new opportunities in Romania. This is a familiar story to anyone who has seriously studied previous enlargements. As countries move towards EU membership, they become more attractive places for the best and brightest people to return to take a new job or start up a business. And we should, dear friends, also not forget the significance of Turkey in helping to balance the disproportionate demographics facing Europe in just a few decades. I'm sure that part of my pension check will depend on the contributions of a young, well-trained Turkish engineer working in the single market in Europe. This leads me into a very hot debate in Europe right now, whether to liberalize further the possibilities for workers to move freely across the enlarged Union. The experience of this country, the United Kingdom, shows clearly that there are major benefits to be gained from opening up labor markets to new member states. The many people from the new member states working here have contributed some £500 million to the British economy, and only a tiny percentage have sought social assistance. These Poles, Lithuanians, Slovaks, and others are predominantly hardworking young people who are gaining experience abroad while saving up for the future. And most intend to return home later on, taking back capital and new skills that will benefit their country's economies. This, I should call, temporary migration is more brain gain than brain drain. It is also better for both the exchequer and the rule of law if people work legally rather than remain unprotected and open to exploitation in the informal grey economy. This experience is rather similar to what happened after Greece, Portugal and Spain joined the EU in the 1980s when fears of a major disruption of labour markets proved to be unfounded. Ireland and Sweden have also welcomed workers from the new member states and their economies have benefited. I hope that the other member states will consider lifting their restrictions in May when the first 2 years of the transition period on the movement of workers will come to an end. Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, there's been quite some debate on enlargement of the Union recently, future enlargement, and I welcome, of course, such debate. It is legitimate and useful to keep discussing the challenges posed by enlargement and how to meet these challenges. We should, in this debate, underline the consolidation of our enlargement agenda and consider how to increase the absorption capacity of the European Union. This debate has been going on for over 4 decades now, and it has been very comprehensive and inclusive. However, it should not be used to question our existing commitments under the consolidated enlargement agenda in southeastern Europe, that is Bulgaria, Romania, the Western Balkans and Turkey. The EU has given all these countries the prospect of EU accession once they can meet the strict conditions of membership. I trust that European leaders will conduct a responsible debate that does not question these commitments and erode our credibility in demanding that these countries meet our standards. Otherwise, we would seriously weaken our ability to work for stability and democracy in the Western Balkans and thus harm Europe's own fundamental interests. The accession process is indeed helping to create, to keep stable some of the most volatile parts of Europe, such as the Western Balkans, and it is delivering practical results in political and economic reforms in the candidate countries. It is much better to export stability to the Western Balkans through the enlargement process than to import instability in the shape of refugees and criminal activities. Therefore, Europe's commitment is so vital, and we have to have a credible commitment towards the European accession perspective of these countries. Enlargement policy should not be held hostage to a theological debate about the ideal shape of the perfect union or even the final borders of Europe. We now have, as I said, a consolidated enlargement agenda. Therefore, a theoretical discussion about whether Ukraine should eventually join the EU would benefit neither the Union nor the Ukrainians at this point of time, which is politically particularly sensitive for Ukraine. Let's respect the principle of Article 49 of the EU treaties, which states that any European country that respects and applies European values, especially democracy, human rights, rule of law, and fundamental freedoms, may apply for EU membership. That does not mean that every European country must apply, or that the EU has to accept every country. But it does mean that we should remain open to changes on our continent. To close the door forever by drawing a line across the map to define Europe once and for all would not be good for us or for any of our neighbors and partners. Sometimes the art of politics requires the art of ambiguity. Enlargement also has a very strong democratic legitimacy. Let's remember that 19 of the current 25 member states were once enlargement countries, including my own and including William's and many of your countries. And every accession is agreed unanimously by all the member states and with the assent of the European Parliament. Ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, my strategy for the and the Commission strategy for the future of enlargement is based on three C's: consolidation, conditionality, and communication. Meaning consolidation of the enlargement agenda into Southeast Europe, meaning rigorous application of strict conditionality when dealing with the candidate countries, and better communication in explaining both the objectives and challenges of enlargement. I'm sure this is the best way to ensure that enlargement is not made a scapegoat for the domestic problems in Europe, but is seen as the success story it really is. The mission of enlargement is a vital part of the history of the European Union. That mission is very much alive today and in the future. Thank you for your attention, and I very much look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to remind you that this lecture is part of the LSE's European series this year, sponsored by the European Institute and supported by the LSE Fund. The next lecture will be next Wednesday, when Pierre Moscovici, former French minister, will be talking on the topic Anglo-Saxon or Continental Model the EU's future. And there are a number of other lectures planned for later in the term. Now what I'd like to do is to invite questions. I think there are microphones downstairs and upstairs, good. And I will do my best to group them, although I'm not sure whether Ollie is going to be able to take notes on what you say, because I do understand from the FT diary, the European edition, that he slipped in between the sauna and the lake on the snow the other day, and that his thumb may not be in as good condition as it might be.
And when we are talking about a Finn, I have to add that no alcohol involved.
I'm extremely glad he only got me to take a sauna in the summer. Let's take that question up there.
Thank you. Commissioner, I'd like to ask whether the Commission has found itself in uncharted waters by incorporating the divided island of Cyprus, and what it intends to do in dealing with that issue.
I can guess where some of those people come from. Yes, one in the middle, the young woman with the white top.
Ensinnäkin kiitos läsnäolosta Olli Rehnille. My question is, you talk a lot about economical impacts and importance of EU enlargement, but how important yourself see the political continuation, considering constitutes and project like working with EU itself to adapt enlargement?
Okay, I'll take one more from upstairs, and the next time I come downstairs, take the one up there.
Hello. I actually had two questions. One is very simple. It is just in your opinion, the biggest problem of EU right now today and the biggest advantage. And the second one, it sounds a bit like utopia, but how you personally answer the question about Russia and the EU and where you actually see the limits of European Union? Thank you.
I have to add, just before I ask Ollie to reply, I recall hearing a Spanish minister 2 years ago say that we had to recognize that when the Baltic states joined the European Union, the EU would have a direct frontier with Russia. And we had to remind him gently that Finland was already a member of the European Union.
Thanks, Billy. I'm very grateful for your comment, reminding the minister. Thanks for these questions. First, concerning Cyprus and the sad fact that Cyprus is still a divided island. We are, of course, working in order to facilitate, first of all, better economic and trade relations inside Cyprus and between Cyprus and the European Union in order to create confidence and end the economic isolation of the Turkish Cypriot community, which is currently the case. Of course, in the longer term, sooner rather than later, we should pursue a resumption of the talks on a comprehensive settlement on Cyprus as well. During my so far 14 months in office as the Enlargement Commissioner, we have made two serious efforts to deblock certain proposals related to enhancing financial assistance and direct trade for the northern part of Cyprus. And we have unfortunately failed both times. The Commission has made two proposals, one in order to provide financial assistance for the northern part of Cyprus, and the other to enhance direct trade between the northern part of Cyprus and the rest of the European Union. These proposals are currently blocked in the Council of Ministers of the European Union, and we are searching for ways and means to deblock
these two regulations in order to honor the EU's commitment given in April 2004 to work in order to end economic isolation of the Turkish Cypriot community. Moreover, I must say that when I visited Cyprus some time ago, I felt a bit like in a time warp, like going back to the early 1980s or late 70s to Berlin, Checkpoint Charlie. It is not a very positive sight to see a divided country in the European Union, a country which should be in peace and unified like the other member states of the European Union. Therefore, I'm very committed to work for the short-term measures of ending the economic isolation of the Turkish Cypriot community and in order to resume talks on a comprehensive settlement in Cyprus. I'm sure that the accession negotiations with Turkey will help us in order to achieve this objective. Concerning the question by the Finnish student who said I focused pretty much on economic dimension, that is correct. We are in the London School of Economics and Political Science. But I see that the two dimensions must move ahead in parallel. And in fact, as regards the political development of the European Union, we all know that we currently have the reflection pause going on concerning the constitutional treaty after it was rejected in the two referenda in France and the Netherlands. And in my view, we should soon move from a pause to a reflection, and we should start a serious debate on ways and means how we can come out of this stalemate and how we can resume serious work in order to achieve a constitutional reform or an institutional reform or a treaty change which will make the European Union more effective and democratic and which will facilitate reinforcing our common foreign and security policy. The need for these objectives, making the Union more effective and more democratic, more open and more able to act as a global player, the need of this has not disappeared anywhere with the two failed referenda. It is ever more present, ever more burning, and therefore we should, in my view, look for ways and means both concerning what kind of institutional reforms are needed and what kind of reforms we can do without any treaty changes of the Union. Finally, concerning the question on Russia, in my view, the European Union and Russia should be strategic partners on an equal footing, and it is important that the European Union should sharpen its own strategy, its own policy vis-à-vis Russia. I would like to recommend the recent book by Chris Patten, who is the Chancellor of the Oxford University, former Commissioner for External Relations. He provides a very vivid and realistic account on the divisions between the EU member states on our Russia and China policy, and regrets why we don't have a more common European approach. I think we should aim at that because all the EU countries would benefit from a more unified common approach towards the Russian Federation. But one thing is worth recalling, Russia is not considering sending an application to the European Union. Therefore, this is a theoretical question. And in any case, I would like to remind the country which is the country which is currently chairing the Council of Europe that in interstate relations inside Europe, we have reached the state of evolution that might is not the only right. And that's very important, especially for the smaller countries in the European Union, and that is the prism through which we are looking in these smaller countries the future development of the Russian Federation.
Thank you. Let's take some downstairs. Yes, at the back.
Commissioner, as an adroit politician, you successfully quarantined the obvious question about the future of EU enlargement, which is, where will the borders stop? So I won't irritate you by asking, where will the borders stop? However, the Commission obviously must have some sort of contingency plan. So my question is, imagine over the next few months that Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and perhaps several of the Stans turn up and said, the United Nations says we're Europe, we believe we're Europe, we want to join. What will the Commission do?
Jonathan, you shock me. I thought you knew that the Georgian government now flies two flags. The second one is blue with some yellow stars around, or they're way ahead. Yes, down at the front here.
In addition to the previous question concerning Cyprus, can the European Union force Turkey to recognize Cyprus as it is before a sustainable solution is found to that problem?
Okay. Yes, the lady in the blue, and...
Okay. Imagining theoretically that states of former Yugoslavia have fulfilled their obligations towards the ICTY, especially Serbia, what do you see as the greatest challenges in their road towards EU membership? And if there are any differences between the states of former Yugoslavia in their capacity, preparedness, and political will and existence of consensus?
Thank you. And am I allowed to add to that? How many states from the Western Balkans do you expect to join the European Union?
That's a tricky one. That's a tricky one. First, concerning the question related to the countries of the Caucasus, the European Union is working on the basis of European neighborhood policy with these countries, and it is an effective policy which brings practical, concrete results. It aims at enhancing economic and trade relations with these countries and the European Union. For instance, enabling negotiating a free trade agreement. As well, it is producing enhanced political dialogue between these countries and the European Union. And it prioritizes these countries concerning, say, the Europeanization of citizens in terms of traveling visa requirements and in terms of scholarships and award programs. Therefore, it is sensible to work on the basis of European neighborhood policy and with this means bring and help these countries to come closer to the European Union. I think President Yushchenko and the leaders of these countries you mentioned have been very wise that they have not sent a premature application for the European Union. Concerning Turkey's obligations vis-à-vis Cyprus, it was indeed discussed quite thoroughly and deeply in the run-up to the 3rd of October, when the accession negotiations were started with Turkey. And the unanimous agreement between the 25 member states was that the European Union expects Turkey to sign the additional protocol of the Ankara Agreement. Sorry about this EU jargon or EU-Turkish jargon. But it effectively means that Turkey needs to extend its current contractual arrangements with the European Union to all new member states, including the Republic of Cyprus. The most important substantive element of this Ankara Agreement currently is the customs union between the EU and Turkey. And therefore, we expect that Turkey extends the customs union fully also to the Republic of Cyprus. However, formal recognition of the Republic of Cyprus by Turkey was not expected as a condition to start the accession negotiations. Now, Turkey has signed this protocol before the accession negotiations were started sometime in July last year, and now, of course, we expect that Turkey in good faith and in due course, without delay, will fully implement this protocol in order to honor its commitments which were taken before the accession negotiations were started. At the same time, even though there is no linkage between these two issues, at the same time, it is worth recalling that we are working in order to make the European Union honor its commitments concerning the Turkish Cypriot community, which the Union undertook in April 2004 after the failed referenda on the Annan plan to reunify the island and before the enlargement with EU-10 countries took place. We have, I would say, and as the Finnish ambassador is in the audience, I would particularly like to point this to the Finnish presidency of the Union in the second half of 2006. There will be two major challenges in the EU-Turkey relations in the course of 2006, probably being particularly in the limelight towards the end of the year. One is a certain slowing down of the reform process, especially concerning freedom of expression. And the second one is respect of Turkey concerning its commitments in relation to the continuing normalization of relations with the Republic of Cyprus. We need to see concrete progress and commitments respected in the course of this year in order to avoid negative ramifications to the accession negotiations. I'm sure the Turkish embassy is present, so you can report this to my friend Abdullah Gül to Ankara as well. Then on ICTY and the countries of former Yugoslavia or the Western Balkans, I would say there are two linked, two interrelated major challenges. If we forget theoretically ICTY as you suggested, and of course it varies from country to country, but there is one common denominator, and that is problems related to institutions and administrative capacity, especially the rule of law and functioning of the judiciary and public administration is a reason for concern. And therefore, in fact, as there are many students of international relations here present, for sure, we have a very concrete case of state building and institution building going on currently in the Western Balkans. And that's why I'm concerned of those voices who question our commitment to the Western Balkans, because we have to see that we are and we must be in the long term engaged in the Western Balkans in order to bring these countries to the European mainstream and help building stable states and stronger institutions. How many countries of the Western Balkans? That's a very smart question, but you don't have to respond to all smart questions. Of course, it's related to the fact that it is likely that Montenegro is going to hold a referendum on independence in April, and it is related to the question of the status process of Kosovo, without prejudging the outcome. But my aim is that when I finish my current term of office as the Enlargement Commissioner in October 2009, if the European Parliament so permits, we have around 27 member states in the European Union. We have Croatia at the final stages of its accession process or even beyond that. We have the rest of the Western Balkans countries well on track towards the European Union, and we have Turkey well on its way in its long and winding road through reforms towards the European Union. That's not a dream, that's a very concrete vision, and I hope to achieve this in the course of the coming years. Not only me, of course, all those people responsible for reforming these countries.
Thank you. Let's take some more. This young lady down here. There's a microphone coming to you.
With regard the level of corruption and organized crime in some of the future EU countries such as Romania and Bulgaria, are there any benchmarks they must achieve, and what are the chances of them failing?
Romania and Bulgaria, right. It's the man in the cap. I'll take three downstairs this time and three upstairs next time, okay?
Yeah, my question is, the French Interior Minister, Mr. Nicolas Sarkozy, last week, he said that the future EU enlargements beyond Bulgaria and Romania should be suspended. As an answer to this, the French Foreign Minister, he said that this is certainly not the view of the French government. From what you said, it really sounds that you support the EU enlargement and you want it to happen. And when the politicians in the member states, such as France, which is almost the most influential one, are divided or do not want to see any more EU enlargement, do you really see your vision of making the EU large happening?
Okay. Yes. And here in the middle.
Commissioner Rehn, you emphasize correctly the dialectics between the political area and the economic area in the enlargement of the European Union. I think probably you have left behind totally the cultural dimension and how far this is important in the cohesion and the development of a kind of closer knit Europe, taking into consideration the cultural dimension. Now, this is very important when we come to consider problems within the European Union, such as Cyprus, that was mentioned before, where we have two peoples living together and civilizations really mingling very well before and when the political situation collapsed. And this we see in cases of economical crisis too. When economic crisis and political crisis ensue, then we have the cohesion and the unison of people because of their civilization. This is what is happening in Cyprus. And what do you think that the situation in Cyprus would be facilitated by the withdrawal of the occupation Turkish troops in Cyprus? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. First, concerning corruption and crime in Bulgaria and Romania, which is the critical yardstick or the critical question when we have to assess the readiness of these two countries to join the Union in 2007. We are preparing currently our final report. We are preparing it in the next few months with numerous fact-finding missions and peer reviews in Bulgaria and Romania. And I would be much better informed to respond to your question sometime in April or May. But it is clear that you don't uproot corruption in 10 months. It might take rather 10 years or 20 years. But the point as regards the accession to the European Union is that we are evaluating whether these two countries, each on the basis of their own merits, have been able to put the structural conditions into such a shape that they are really able to fight the corruption and organized crime. And therefore, both countries are now engaged in very serious reforms of their judiciary, of their prosecutors, of their police, and of their anti-corruption offices. I certainly very much hope that both countries will be able to conduct and finalize these reforms this spring, so that we can be sure that they have the sufficient structural conditions to fight the corruption and organized crime. These are specifically defined in the accession treaty, and we are making an objective and fair assessment on the basis of these yardsticks and empirical evidence we get from our fact-finding missions. Secondly, concerning Mr. Sarkozy and the views and debate in France, I do not comment on the statement of any minister in France, but generally speaking, I welcome debate on enlargement, but I hope it is not going to be an existential debate, because it would not be very beneficial for the European Union. I'm referring to what I said earlier on Ukraine, for instance. Rather, I would welcome a responsible debate on the consolidation of our enlargement agenda, on the absorption capacity of the European Union, what is needed in order to reform the policies, the budget, and the institutions of the European Union, so that we are able to absorb new members in the future. That is a very relevant debate, and it's related to the earlier question of the Finnish student on the constitutional reform and the political strengthening of the European Union. Finally, question on the cultural dimension, which your question described well the situation, for instance, in Cyprus or in the Western Balkans. In my view, it is very important that in the enlargement policy we take into account also the cultural dimension, and that we move from, say, technical to the communicative. We are quite good in running the technical negotiations for accession, which is of course the core business of a DG enlargement or enlargement department in the European Commission. But we are certainly not as good in communicating enlargement. And that is one of the, if not the key priority of my work and our work this year and in the coming years, in order to better explain what enlargement is about, explain its clear benefits for the European Union, why it is a success story, and also analyze and admit the problems it is causing to the citizens and member states of the European Union. One of the tools we have at our disposal is the civil society dialogue, which we aim at enhancing by also financing this dialogue, and I hope that those who are interested in an organized civil society dialogue between EU citizens and citizens of the candidate countries could sometime in spring, summer, click our website and check what kind of opportunities there are, because we shall allocate some 40 million euros in the coming years to enhance this kind of civil society dialogue between, say, women's organizations, student associations, journalists associations, business associations, you name it, and thus combat prejudice and increase mutual understanding between, for instance, EU citizens and Turkish citizens. Please use these opportunities, which will be at your disposal from the summer onwards.
Thank you. Let's take some more from upstairs. The young lady with the red hair.
Commissioner, you said that you don't believe that the end of Europe should be marked on the map clearly. In context of that, what do you think the role of EU is in support of the reform in Ukraine? And in particular, and what actions EU is prepared to take, and in particular, could you evaluate the reaction of the EU to the gas conflict between the Russia and the Ukraine?
Shall I take the one on the absolutely far corner, just to be a nuisance?
Hi, Mr. Rain. I'm actually so disappointed in you that I've tried to not laugh at your jokes this evening. I'm quite disappointed at two aspects. One of them is you mentioned good politics being might having to be ambiguous, but I don't think it's good politics for an 18-year-old Turkish Cypriot or an 18-year-old Kurdish person to not be able to see their future for the ambiguity that's surrounding their future. Why haven't you used your power to perhaps... Okay, you've mentioned freedom of speech in Turkey, but why have you not demanded from the Turkish government some kind of compensation for the years of suppression that the Kurdish people have had to face in eastern Turkey? And why have you not... I can understand your dialogue with North Cyprus and Mr. Talat, but why have you not said to Mr. Papadopoulos, if you do not sit down to these negotiations in a more positive way, then we will impose strict consequences for you? We've mentioned the fact that you wanted the Turkish troops out of North Cyprus. Of course, I mean, as a Turkish Cypriot, I do not believe that the Turkish troops should be in North Cyprus. However, the United Nations plan did state that with saying yes to the UN plan, then the Turkish troops would have left, 40,000 Turkish troops would have left. The southern Cypriots have said no to this, and the reward was... you accepting them to the EU. What will you do now?
Okay. And the one up at the back.
Commissioner, I'm extremely disappointed by your somewhat patronizing and dismissive attitude towards Ukraine joining the European Union. Ukraine's Europe's largest democracy, and it's just come out a democratic revolution out of hundreds of years of oppression. Do you not think that you should be talking up its prospects of joining the EU more? And do you not think that the fact that the wheels are coming off the Orange Revolution is partly down to your fault and the fault of others in the EU
for can not being? I can't hear.
Do you not think that the fault that the wheels seem to be coming off the Orange Revolution in Ukraine is somewhat your fault and the fault of others in the EU that don't seem to be accepting their possible membership?
I think you all now understand, first, that the Commissioner has a great deal of power, and. Secondly, that this is not an easy job.
Thank you. First, if I have power, I have very soft power concerning Ukraine. Because, in fact, and this is serious, it inside the Commission, it belongs... to the commissioner responsible for external relations, Mrs. Benita Ferrero-Waldner. And I'm, of course, responsible for the commission's policy vis-à-vis Ukraine as a member of the commission on the basis of collegiality that we practice. But the point is, more serious point is that we are working seriously in order to bring Ukraine closer to the European Union on the basis of those tools that we have available under European neighborhood policy. And they are very similar tools that we are working together with the countries of the Western Balkans, for instance. We are trying to build stronger institutions, enhance the rule of law and judiciary reform. We are working in order to enhance economic and trade relations, including negotiating a free trade agreement. And we are having a very intensive political dialogue, and we are providing political support for the democratic development of Ukraine. These are concrete things which help to bring Ukraine closer to the European Union, and we shouldn't underestimate these important and valuable actions that we are currently undertaken. We should start with this and make serious progress. And at the same time, as I said in my speech, it is better not to have such a theoretical debate on the borders of Europe which would hurt the interests of Ukraine or Europe concerning this particular important country. Secondly, concerning Turkey, the Kurds and Cyprus, concerning the Kurdish issue, there are both certain positive developments and some negative developments, certainly. And first, one must regret that the Turkish government, despite its openness to discuss more openly the Kurdish issue and the development of the Southeast, has not been able to put enough effort on the economic and social development of the Southeast of Turkey, which would be extremely important. In addition to that, it is important that Turkey will enhance cultural rights and language rights of Kurdish people in Turkey, and there has been certain progress, but unfortunately rather limited progress in terms of teaching Kurdish and having certain radio and television broadcasts in the Kurdish language. But it's a very important issue also from the point of view of the accession negotiations, and our objective is to encourage Turkey to seriously focus on the economic and social development of the Southeast and to enhance cultural and linguistic rights of its citizens. Concerning Cyprus, in fact, the question, for instance, of the Turkish troops in Cyprus was a part of the Annan plan, which in 2004 aimed at reunifying the island. This plan was subject to a referendum in both the Turkish Cypriot community and the Greek Cypriot community. It was overwhelmingly supported among the Turkish Cypriot community, but rejected by 75% of the voters in the Greek Cypriot community, and thus this effort of reunification unfortunately failed. The question of the Turkish troops is a part of a comprehensive settlement, and the sooner we can start serious work, serious negotiations, serious talks on a comprehensive settlement, the better. In the meantime, we are working with smaller steps in order to build confidence and enhance economic and trade relations inside Cyprus and between Cyprus and the European community. We need a lot of patience there, and it is really saddening that we have a member state in the Union which is so divided and where reunification has not taken place.
I think that leaves time for perhaps one final round of questions. Let me take one from upstairs and some from downstairs. The man in the dark orange top.
It's a Ukrainian revolution, seemingly, so please. Are you Ukrainian or?
No, I'm from Kosovo, and my question has.
That's easy. Much easier for you.
Equally challenging.
Well, not disappointed in what you said, because you didn't say anything about the future of Kosovo. I would like to know, when will the citizens of former Yugoslavia be able to travel freely in Europe, in the European Union?
Okay, that's quite straightforward. Yes,
there.
Commissioner, you mentioned that on its agenda, the EU has two challenges in 2006 in its relations with Turkey. And my question relates to whether EU can see a further challenge in its relations with Turkey, the normalization of Turkey's relations with Armenia.
Let me take Two more. This one down here.
Mr. Commissioner, you kind of referred to this question already, but I'd like a direct answer. How do we find the support for enlargement from the citizens of the old member states? I think we have a real problem there.
That's a very good question. And this question here.
Britain was in favor of 8 Eastern European countries joining the EU, so it is for Turkey. Would a rational European be prepared to give a large chunk of political power through the votes in the European Parliament to the largest and the poorest country in Europe? And the question in the end of the day is, who is paying for the bill, and who will enjoy the geopolitical situation of a limited integrated European Union?
Some simple questions to end with.
Thank you, William. These are indeed rather challenging questions to respond concisely, but I try my best. First, concerning traveling possibilities of the citizens of the Western Balkans, we have just recently finalized a proposal which we will present next week, which will include several policy measures for the Western Balkans, from a free trade area, regional free trade area, to enhanced political cooperation, and also covering the Europeanization of the next generation, or why not the current generation. In practice, this means especially two things. It means steps in visa facilitation for certain targeted groups, such as students and researchers. And it means a significant increase of scholarships and grants, which help students from these countries to study in the European Union. In practice, I can't yet reveal the full content, because my colleagues want to have a say on it next week. But I would expect that I will get support in the college for a decision to get negotiating mandates on visa facilitation accepted for the Western Balkans countries, starting with the new candidate country, that is the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and then the other countries would follow in the course of 2006, so that we would achieve this visa facilitation, which means an easier and cheaper access to visas to enter the European Union for students and scholars. However, this is in the hands of the member states, because inside the European Union they have the competences, they have the powers to decide on these matters. But I'm reasonably confident that we have support of the member states, but on one condition, and that's important, that all the countries help themselves and their citizens to achieve visa facilitation by agreeing on readmission agreements and their credible implementation, which means effective border control systems and effective rule of law systems in these countries. Thus, I'm confident that we will make serious progress in the course of this year, and you shouldn't be disappointed, but rather satisfied with this. Let's discuss this further, say, towards the end of the year. Let's see what we have achieved concretely. Concerning Kosovo, by the way, the process, as you well know, as you all know, the process of defining the future status of Kosovo has started recently. The United Nations has appointed President Martti Ahtisaari as a special envoy to conduct these negotiations. And we are supporting President Ahtisaari on his work, and we are especially taking care that whatever the precise outcome of this status process will be, that Kosovo will have a concrete European perspective, and this status outcome will be compliant with its European aspirations. The second question concerned Turkey and the Armenian border. If you allow a slightly lighter approach, we can say that for once Armenia may have been satisfied that the border is closed when the bird flu occurred in eastern Turkey. More seriously, it is a very damaging thing that the border between Turkey and Armenia is closed, has been closed for years. It is very harmful for the economy of Armenia, very harmful for the economy of eastern Turkey, the area of Kars. Those who have read Snow by Orhan Pamuk are familiar with the city of Kars and what can happen if there is a snowstorm. And therefore, it makes full sense to both Turkey and Armenia, political sense and economic sense, to move towards the opening of the border relatively soon. This is regularly discussed in our contacts between the Turkish government and the European Union, and we are encouraging Turkey to proceed towards this direction, because one condition in the accession negotiations is normal, good neighborly relations with the neighboring countries. And therefore, we expect that Turkey and Armenia, which is part of the European neighborhood policy, will both proceed towards normalization of their relations. Both will benefit from it, and I think we should less look at past injustices and more focus on future opportunities that we have also in that part of the world. Then a very easy question concerning what can be done to encourage our citizens to be informed, better informed, and understand enlargement policy. Indeed, I'm quite well aware that there is a certain enlargement blues, enlargement fatigue among citizens, especially in the older EU member states. I spent part of my summer holiday last August in France and in Germany, partly to polish my linguistic skills and partly just to feel the mood, follow the public debate, and get a touch how the people really think and why they are so critical of enlargement. And it is true that there is this kind of enlargement blues, but I think the critical thing is that we shouldn't make enlargement a scapegoat of certain economic and social policy failures in our domestic politics, which we have seen, for instance, recently in France. We have seen the discontent in the inner cities and street violence in the inner cities, and it is very difficult to blame enlargement of the European Union for these events. Therefore, the first and foremost priority of the European Union is jobs and growth for the moment. And there we work together with the EU member states in order to combine all the efforts of the Union to enhance innovativeness, competitiveness, and such economic reforms that facilitate better job creation and better sense of security among our publics. We have to address these economic and unemployment problems with appropriate policies, not blame enlargement. Secondly, we need to consolidate our enlargement agenda, as I described in my earlier responses, and we have to ensure that we don't overstretch our capacities. What we do well, but we don't try to eat a too big bite, and instead focus on quality than quantity. And of course, I'm referring to what I said about communication and civil society dialogue. We need to understand that this is not only a technical matter, it is a matter of communication, and we have to address the concerns of our citizens. Finally, concerning Turkey and its role in the EU institutions, if it will be able to meet the conditions of membership in the end of the process, as well as its impact on the budget. I wouldn't overdramatize the share of Turkey in any of the institutions. It is a matter of statutory equality of member states in the European Union that each and every member state has such representation that it is justified to have, and this means that Turkey will have the same kind of representation in the Commission as the other large member states, other currently six large member states. It will have the same share of votes in the Council as the other six large member states, and it will have the same proportion of MEPs and as the other member states of the same category. This means that certainly Turkey would not be able to dictate any decision. Its voting rights, its power in these institutions would be relative to its share in terms of size in compared to overall population of the European Union, which is the principle of which we apply. And concerning the financing of Turkey's possible accession to the European Union, we have next 10 to 15 years to reflect and study that carefully. We have issued already one analysis paper on it in late 2004. You may consult that from the websites of the Commission, and we will repeat the exercise in due course. But one can say that the overall impact of Turkey's accession, about 70 million people, is roughly in the same scale as Eastern and Central European countries joining the European Union, where there is also 70 million people, if you don't count Bulgaria and Romania, which make 30 million people more. And the current Eastern enlargement has not bankrupted Europe. It has not caused a standstill in the European institutions, and it has not caused any major negative economic consequences. I'm sure we can handle also the accession of Turkey, but of course it takes a lot of preparation, and in this regard we are fortunate because we have time, because it will be a long and winding road before Turkey will be able to meet the conditions of accession. I hope it will be able to do so in the end of the road, because Turkey will be a very important bridge between civilizations in Europe, between Europe and the Islamic world.
Oli, thank you very much. I did tell you that we have a tradition of vigorous questioning in LSE meetings. I can assure you I've been in some meetings where the questioning has been much more vigorous than tonight. But I hope you've found it worthwhile. I very much hope you will come again. I know that you were very tactful in not addressing the question of the final boundaries of Europe. That means that academics can enjoy ourselves writing about it for some time. I can see at least two people in the audience who have written on this and will no doubt continue to do so. On one occasion, I attempted to do so, and I put the words Bug and Tigris in the title and suggesting where the boundaries might stretch. The most frequently asked question that anyone came to me was, excuse me, where is the Bug? This shows that the question of the final boundaries of Europe is one which stretches our knowledge of geography as well as our sense of geopolitics. I'd like to thank the Commissioner very much. I hope we'll see him again here. And I hope we will see you at the remaining lectures in the European series starting next Wednesday. Thank you very much indeed.